Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I've got the 60-plus panel back with me in the studio today, and I want to dive right back into our discussion of George Orwell's classic 1984. Now, if you remember, at our last program, we began to talk about some of the characters, and we talked about poor Sim. And Sim was too intelligent. He was too outspoken, and eventually they did vaporize him. So we can be really sad about that. But I thought what I'd do today, panel, is we just start talking about I'd like to focus on Julia and Winston, and I also want to focus on O'Brien, Winston, and Julia. And it seems like to me towards the end of the book, it's this triad kind of takes over, except there are some shocking things in there we want to talk about too. So let's just talk about Julia and Winston and see, Deborah, since we're talking about a female, let me give you the mic and tell us what you think. So,
okay, well, Julia is definitely, in some ways, she becomes, she's almost like a contrast to Winston. They both have rebellious ideas, but her rebellion is more of a personal. She's basically a survivor, and she rebels through sex, basically. She doesn't believe in the rules of the party, but she also doesn't believe that it's possible to overthrow the party. And so she just, it's like she accepts it and just on a personal level does what she can. Whereas in contrast, Winston is more philosophical and concerned with the overall idea of how to remain human under inhuman circumstances, and the idea of personal freedom and all these big ideas. Whereas she doesn't seem to care about that. She's mostly concerned about the here and now, and really, she's really looks like she's a zealous party member. But then she, does things personally in the background just to be rebellious. One of the things she does, she ironically wears an anti-sex sash. it's ironic. She wears the anti-sex sash, and yet she has claims to Winston that she's, had been with quite a few men. So.
I do think that in here, first of all, there's a few things that kind of stand out to me. But we'll just keep it with Julia. I'll probably have to come back maybe and do a final program myself. But one of the things that I think is very clear, and maybe sometimes writers, they put things in there, but they're not as obvious. But if you look at their age difference, okay, I think what Deborah's saying is true. There's a philosophical difference, but there's also an age difference. She's 26, and he's like, 10?
15 years older.
15 years older. And so he has, and it's really interesting how this is all tied to a sense of history. And I think we need to bring this out, is that she's 26, and what she believes is she wants to live. I mean, if she wants to do something that she thinks is pleasurable, she's going to do it. But the way she does it is break the rules. She has no intention of overthrowing the party. She has no intention of, trying to change the environment for everybody. It's what she wants to do. But she is really quite good at it. I mean, here she got into her kind of her sexual revolution when she was 16, but she was with party members. Right. And there's some things we can bring out there too. But even Winston asks her, he says, well, was it with the inner party? She says, oh no. She's there, she goes into this whole thing about they're self-righteous, and, but anyway, it is kind of interesting. I think it's she is so much younger than he is that she just has a different view. And that's the way it is today. I mean, Derry and I both have to work with younger people, teaching, and they just have a different mindset.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true, you know, when you look at Julia, that she is this person who wants to live her own life the way she wants to live it. And she doesn't want to be hampered by these rules that are everywhere. But she plays along with the rules so long as it helps her to achieve what she wants to achieve. And, you know, you can see from her attitude, the way that she talks, the way she describes things, she is bitter about the fact that elements of the society are so hypocritical. That, you know, there's chocolate and there's wine and there's all kinds of things with the upper crust, with the people that have the inside of the party. But people like her, who are on the outside of the party, the outside of the inner party, they don't have advantage to any of these things. And she sees that as the big problem with the society. Whereas Winston views it from more, as you said, a philosophical standpoint, more of an intellectual standpoint, that this is an unjust society. She sees injustice as something that you work around, and you make it so that you can make it work for you. Winston's concerned about that society is unjust and needs to be changed. So they're really coming at it from two different ways.
Right, right. The thing is the big thing is he sees the hope for the world,
yes,
in the pearls,
right?
Because
mm-hmm.
they're going to rise Absolutely. Up. And of course, then I don't know if I really want to get into it too much, but I'm sure all of our readers out there probably started reading through the book that O'Brien slips to him I'm sorry, that was some of the most boring reading I've read in a long time.
But it's amazing reading because it's the very thing that the opposition is supposed to be in favor of. You know, it's all twisted and turned around.
Yeah.
Because the book that O'Brien gets and reads has all the elements about the society as it currently exists.
Right.
And yet it's an opposition book.
Right. Right. But it's actually a statement of fact.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But the thing is, I always thought, okay, I need to go back and read this when I'm not under pressure for other things. but I think it's interesting that inside of them, like Deborah said, they both have rebellion. Mm-hmm. And on page 125, I think there's just a good quote to maybe people to get focused in this. He's talking to her, you know, first of all, you know, the party is very much against sex, and she does a great explanation, gives a great explanation of why, is they don't want energy taken away from the party. You know, they don't want people to have, you know, the expensive energy outside of what the party wants. But he's asking her if she's had sex with members of the inner party, and in the middle of the page says, not with those swine, no. But there's plenty that would if they got half a chance. They're not so holy as they make out. And then this is Winston said, his heart leapt scores of times she had done it. He wished it had been hundreds, thousands. Anything that hinted at corruption always filled him with wild hope. Who knew? Perhaps the party was rotten under the surface, its cult of strenuousness and self-denial simply a sham concealing iniquity. And so there you can see that he... In some ways, he's philosophical, but he has this wild sense of rebellion as well. Notice what he says. If he could have infected the whole lot of them with leprosy or syphilis, how gladly he would have done so. Anything to rot, to weaken, to undermine. But he was willing to do anything to weaken the party, but it's what the inner party did to the rest of society to get it to where they could be in control. That's brought out in the Goldstein book.
Absolutely, you know? Right.
Yeah.
And a little bit farther down where he states the same thing. I hate purity. I hate goodness. I don't want any virtue to exist anywhere. I want everyone to be corrupt to the bones. That's because he sees society, this sort of sham society, as being one that holds those up as true values, which it really does not. And so, but he is against those attitudes of virtue because he thinks that's what the society holds up. But it's not really what they hold up because they're corrupt too.
Right. So it is kind of interesting, isn't it? That that here they don't like the traditional values that were all brought about by the kings or by the aristocrats. And they want their own virtues, and their virtues are all corrupt.
That's right.
But it shows that for human beings to really live happily, you do need to have virtues.
Right, right.
You do need to live by virtues.
And you need to have law. And there's something that's stated later on. I think it's in book three it's brought up when this whole interrogation takes place, that O'Brien lets him know that there is no law.
I know.
And when he says, well, of course, there is no law. I mean, everyone does what they want to, you know. And so they have this sham of it looking one way, but it's really something else. People react against that image of what it really is, but that's not what it really is.
No. No, actually, the whole idea of thought crime is there's no laws they're breaking.
That's right. That's right.
There's no laws they're breaking.
There's no law. There's no truth.
That's right.
What is truth?
That's right.
Yeah.
Let's go to page 131, too. I just wanted to bring this out about Julia. And again, I think she's very young. You know, she's 26. I mean, you're hardly an adult by the time you're 26. Anyway, I know when I was 21, I thought I knew everything. But anyway, middle of the page, she says, "Life as she saw it was quite simple. You wanted a good time; they, meaning the party, wanted to stop you having it. You broke the rules as best you could. She seemed to think it was just as natural as they should want to rob you of your pleasures that you should want to avoid being caught. She hated the party, and said so in the crudest words, but she made no general criticism of it. Except where it touched upon her own life, she had no interest in party doctrine. He noticed that she never used newspeak words except the ones that had passed into everyday use. She had never heard of the Brotherhood and refused to believe in its existence. Any kind of organized revolt against the party, which was bound to be failure, struck her as stupid. The clever thing was to break the rules and stay alive all the same. He wondered vaguely how many others like her there might be in the younger generation, people who had grown up in the world of the revolution, knowing nothing else, accepting the party as something unalterable, like the sky, not rebelling against its authority, but simply evading it as a rabbit dodges a dog."
Yeah, very interesting text, that is.
I think it's great writing.
It is. Mm-hmm.
But even as you said in an earlier program, this book is so current.
It is.
I just saw an article before we came over here that in January of 2017 that said it was a bestseller again.
I can see why.
1984 is a bestseller again. So I might have to maximize that later. But anyway, I think one of the big shocking things then for me when as I was reading this is when they get into the inner party goods, she gets in and she starts stealing these. Page 140 is where it starts. It's like, I think Winston, he seems to me, even though he's very philosophical, and you can all agree with me or disagree with me, seems like in some ways he was naive about the inner party, because she knew, and she was still a party member, but somehow she knew that these guys were living high on the hog. Right. I mean, they had wine, they had the best chocolate, they had the best coffee, and there's this whole scene where, of course, they're meeting in their, their shabby room, and she brought in her bag, and he said, of course, he obviously was in love with her, wanted to hug her. She says, "Hey, half a second," she said, "just let me show you what I brought. Did you bring some of that filthy victory coffee?" He said, "I thought you would. You can chuck it away again, because we shan't be needing it. Look here." So that's what she was saying. "Did you bring some of that filthy coffee?" She fell on her knees, threw open the bag, and tumbled out some spanners and a screwdriver that filled the top part of it. Underneath was a number of neat paper packets. The first packet she passed to Winston had a strange and yet vaguely familiar feeling. It was filled with some kind of heavy sand-like stuff which yielded whenever you touched it. "It isn't sugar," he said. "Real sugar," she replies. "Not saccharin, sugar. And here's a loaf of bread, proper white bread." Well, I don't know if we'd agree with white bread being proper, but anyway, proper white bread, not our bloody stuff. and a little pot of jam, and here's a tin of milk. But look, this is the one I'm really proud of. I had to wrap it a bit of sacking around it because, but she did not to tell him why she'd wrapped it up. The smell was already filling the room, a rich, hot smell which seemed like an emanation from his early childhood, but which one did occasionally meet even now, blowing down a passageway before a door slammed and diffusing itself mysteriously in a crowded street, sniffed for an instant and then lost again. "It's coffee," he murmured. "Real coffee." She says, "It's inner party coffee. There's a whole kilo here," she said. "How did you manage to get hold of all these things?" She said, "It's all inner party stuff. There's nothing those swine don't have, nothing. But of course, waiters and servants and people pinch things. And look, I got a little packet of tea as well." To me, maybe I was duped by the book, but I was shocked when I read that. The inner party really has all this stuff. They have servants as well. So anyway, I'll just throw that out now.
I wasn't really shocked. It just shows the hypocrisy.
It does.
Basically.
It does.
Yeah.
And it's so reminiscent mm-hmm. of a communist society.
Right.
I mean, these communist societies, like I remember in Poland and in Czechoslovakia behind the Iron Curtain, the people who worked with the government had everything.
Right.
It was a common man who had nothing, you know.
Yeah.
But they were all made to feel like they were all made to believe that everyone was on the same level.
Right.
And everyone was. The same level mm-hmm. of poverty, except the people there in the party, they all had everything.
Right.
You know?
Well, you remember when we went to Berlin and we went on the other side of the wall, you know, this is when the wall was down and we could just walk in, you know, in East Berlin. And there was this beautiful section where Berlin had been beautiful and most of the other buildings were all torn down. But there, remember this one big beautiful building with gold on it, and that was the party headquarters.
It was the Communist Party headquarters.
And you could tell.
They had everything.
It was beautiful,
right.
Yes.
Yeah. And they even had a fence around it and fountains.
Right.
I think it even had fountains.
Oh, yeah. They lived like kings. They did.
Yeah. So I actually had forgotten about that. But I do remember now when we went to Prague and we stayed in the Best Western, which was the former party headquarters.
Oh, right, yes.
And those rooms were massive for a Holiday Inn. The rooms were massive. I remember that huge bed in there, you know. And we realized, we asked, what was this building? And they said it was the Communist Party headquarters.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, so. But anyway, I do think it's interesting that she reminds me of, I mean, it's almost like, of course, we grew up in the 70s. She reminds me of some of those young girls that I went to school with that were the rebels. You know, they were out there leading the pack. You know, but again, she knew how to do everything so deceitfully. And that's, I think, is another part of the whole everything going on in the book, is everybody's deceiving everybody else.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's just...
And part of it's the fact that that's all she's known.
Right.
I mean, Winston's had the advantage of living before the revolution, whatever that means, but I mean, there was actually a period of time when obviously things weren't the way they are now that he has recollection of. She doesn't. This is all she knows.
Yeah.
So
that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and every now and then he'll have a memory as like a dream, and he'll have a memory or a dream of something from before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think that I think that our readers out there that are reading the book, I don't think you should look at Julia and Winston's relationship or the way that it could appear to be portrayed. I think that Orwell is communicating something more than just a sexual relationship. And I think what he's actually showing that it's like in Winston's generation, the generation that would like to rise up and put in a government that could help the people has passed.
Mm-hmm.
It's passed. Actually, Winston is an old part of the, you know, kind of like an older kind of rebellion. And I think that's also true. And we're even seeing it, even with this recent school shooting. And, you know, now the students down there have been stirred up. And that they've been stirred up by, I'm sorry, the socialists mm-hmm. in this country.
Right.
And then this one girl that comes out and says, well, President Trump's failed us. Congress has failed us. So now we're going to take matters for gun control in our own hands. And honestly, it's going to lead to revolution in the streets is what's going to happen.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, she's going to be toting a gun
right.
before too
mm-hmm.
long. And so I think in some ways, you know, like I said, that with the Goldstein chapters, there's actually only two chapters that they reveal of that book but they're long.
They're long. They're long and involved.
It was hard for me to get through,
yeah. But the point is, it's really was, I'm going to say, 19th century thinking anyway. It was the way they analyzed society. Right. Of course, we have a whole different view of what government should be. And I know America's not perfect, but it was sure a lot better than a lot of other things,
right.
You know, going on in the world. And it's sure a lot better than what was going on in Russia. I mean, I'm talking about me growing up in the 50s and 60s. I still feel obviously very blessed I grew up American than not Russian.
Oh, yeah,
or,
absolutely.
You know, Eastern European or, right. You know, or even in China. I mean, we talked about China in the on. I mean, they really are oppressed peoples,
yes.
You know, but the right. People at the top, look at the Ming Dynasty, look at the glory and the extravagance they lived in.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we have all the jade art artifacts. Right. I took the Chinese art class, which was just fabulous. So I think one of the things is that Churchill really is talking a lot about history, actually, in their relationship.
Mm-hmm. Churchill?
I mean, not Churchill, Orwell.
Orwell.
Orwell is really talking a lot about about history, and that, you know, she has no caring for history.
No. And one of the things that he brings out, too, and he mentions this at one point in the book, is that everything has come so politicized that there is no longer any ability to have pure emotion anymore, that it's all either fear or hatred.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's become a political act. And so that's what happens when everything becomes totally politicized. And, we see that in society today. It's that way. And so it becomes it boils down into fear and hatred. Are you on the side that's ruling? And so there's fear if you're not, and there's hatred if you are. You know, it's that kind of thing. I think that relationship between the two of them brings out a lot in their conversations, the things that he says, to help you understand where they're coming from and how they're thinking. And they're both, as you say, rebels, and they have elements of rebellion in them, but they're coming at it from different angles.
Completely different. And, it is, I think this whole section in here on history, and it really starts around page 153 for all of your listening out there. This is the conversations between the two of them. And you can almost see it's like he was reading her the Goldstein book and she's falling asleep. She could have cared less. Meanwhile, he's devouring it. But right a little bit below the middle of the page, it's in the middle of the paragraph, the quote goes, "Often she was ready to accept the official mythology simply because the difference between the truth and falsehood did not seem important to her. She believed, for instance, having learned it at school, that the party had invented airplanes. In his own school days, Winston remember, in the late 50s, it was only the helicopter that the party claimed to have invented. A dozen years later, when Julia was at school, it was already claiming the airplane. One generation more, and it would be claiming the steam engine. And when he told her that the airplanes had been in existence before he was born and long before the Revolution, the fact struck her as totally uninteresting. After all, what did it matter who invented airplanes?" It's like if you wipe out history.
Right. The principle of anything doesn't matter anymore. You know.
No, just, it doesn't. What does truth matter?
Right.
Well, it doesn't. After all, what did it matter who invented airplanes? It was rather more of a shock to him when he discovered from some chance remark that she did not remember that Oceania 4 years ago had been at war with East Asia and at peace with Eurasia. It was true that she regarded the whole war as a sham, but apparently she had not even noticed that the name of the enemy had changed.
Oh, details.
Yeah. But you know, we talk a lot here at the college about the importance of learning from history. And I think that is I think what Orwell saw even then, he saw history being destroyed.
And a rewriting of history, which is what we see today, reinterpretation
history.
Of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he started, but it's interesting. He goes on then, it says, "In the end, he's succeeding in forcing her memory back until she did firmly recall that at one time East Asia and not Eurasia had been the enemy, but the issue still struck her as unimportant. Who cares, she said impatiently. It's always one bloody war after another, And no one knows the news is all lies anyway. And one knows the news is all lies anyway.
We could almost say that today, couldn't we?
I think we can. And I do think...
Fake news.
Yeah, but I do think we don't see the danger in it.
No.
You know, it's like... Because I can do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like... I listen to every newscast with a grain of salt. But we should be like Orwell and say, this is a real problem.
Right.
This is a real problem that people are being fed lies. Because you know... Everyone else out there is turning it off too.
Right.
So then what happens is you're lost. You don't even know current events.
Right.
You know what's really important.
Right.
You know, you don't know what's happening. And that's why, you know, paying attention to thetrumpet.com, I believe, is very important for people, because we're doing every major effort we can to bring them the news.
And the truth.
The truth about the news, and analyzing why this is not good for our world.
Right.
And so there's my plug for thetrumpet.com. If you don't follow it, please, you know, get on the internet and go look at it. That's thetrumpet.com. So we're going to take a quick break here, and then we're going to come back. And so we'll be back in just a few minutes.
You're listening to Just the Best Literature with Dennis Leib on 101.3 KPCG.
Well, hello again. We're back. And I thought what we'd do, panel, since we're having such a great discussion, is let's now shift our discussion to O'Brien. And, of course, you can't talk about O'Brien without talking about Winston and Julia anyway, so they're going to be in the background. But I do think one of the things I think that Orwell does a great thing. You notice all through the book and all the time in their relationship, there is this element of foreboding is always there. They said, eventually, they're going to find us. Eventually, they're going to catch us. Eventually, you know, they're going to put us in a room, and they're going to want us to confess, and it's all going to be over. And you know, so they have this, and so within this supposedly, you know, romantic relationship, and you know, in the midst of all this discussion, you keep being told it's going to end. It's going to end. It's going to end. So it does make you want to read forward to find out what, you know, how it does. But it's interesting that O'Brien is the one that kind of gave Winston hope in the beginning. It's, you know, at the very beginning he says, I forget exactly what the phrase is, but when we meet again, it'll be in the light,
right.
You know, something like that. And then I think that really that one thing is Winston felt he could connect with him. You know, he was not as afraid of him, but as it turns out, that's the person he should have been afraid of.
Right.
You know, so, but it is kind of interesting that there comes to this point in their relationship where they decide they have to go and they have to talk to O'Brien.
Yeah, and that whole thing is very curious. You know, how it is that that O'Brien was made to feel that somehow there would be this connection with, or Winston was made to feel there would be this connection with O'Brien. And, of course, you wonder later, after you sort of see the denouement of all this, you wonder, well, is that what the inner party members are able to do? They're able to project an image to people that forced them to come to them, thinking that they're on the same side that against the party, when they're really the ones that are defending the party.
Yeah,
and so they flush people out that way.
Yeah, they're like the super party.
Yes, right.
But it is interesting that even early in the book, when Winston goes through this whole scenario of he really wants to preserve his thoughts, and he goes to the curiosity shop or the antique shop. And he buys the journal, you know, and so that's a total setup for big surprise towards the end of the book. But anyway, and he actually says, I'm actually writing the journal for O'Brien. Do you remember that statement?
Yes.
So he's thinking that he needs to save O'Brien.
Yeah. And you think, how did that ever develop? What was just from looking at someone or a side glance, you would draw that conclusion? Yeah. I mean,
somehow they felt they could see the connection that there was an intellectual, I think, connection or ability or something that was interesting.
Because Julia agrees with him. Julia agreed with him that he had that connection with O'Brien.
Yes, she felt the same thing.
And here she would be the most radical against doing something like that. But then here it's almost like just the total throes of evil when we find out that they've been set up all along.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost like they even use their relationship against them, you know. And then they catch two. They didn't catch just one. They caught two, you know. And so how much of the time did they suspect her, you know? But anyway,
it does show you the sinister nature of the thought police, because that's the thing that he feared the most was the thought police, because he wanted to protect his thoughts and make sure that was the one thing over which he had power, were his thoughts.
Right.
And that no one, and even she felt that to a degree, that the thought was processed. That was something that they couldn't make you think another way that you really thought. I mean, you could pretend like you were a certain way, but they couldn't change your thinking.
But then they do change.
But then they do.
Yes. Well, I don't know. Is this jumping ahead? There's one thing where he's thinking after. You know, the sessions, but the 2 + 2 = 5. But anyway, he says, just page 290, he says, he remembers, they can't get inside you, she had said, but they could get inside you.
Right.
Yeah. What happens to you, you hear us forever, O'Brien said. That was a good, true word. There were things, your own acts, from which you could not recover. So something was killed in your breast, burnt out, cauterized out.
It's just a fact that they know. I mean, we've had a whole history of torture from World War II and Vietnam War and Korean War. I mean, a person can be broken down.
Right. And the sinister thing about this is it's not just the act of breaking someone down, but it's giving the impression that this is someone you can confide in.
Right.
And this is a confidant and a friend and someone who thinks like you. And then the son discovered that's the very one I should have been avoiding all along, because that's the one that really betrayed. It's betrayal is what
it's
it
betrayal.
Is.
It's
very,
betrayal.
Very
deep.
Yeah. Let's go back just to, I'd like to go back and just, we'll talk about the writing. I mean, that is part of what we're here for, is to talk about the writing. But let's go back to page 167. They were motivated. It's almost like they knew, they could sense it, that their relationship was going to end. And then it's chapter 8 there. It says they had done it. They had done it at last. The room they were standing in was long-shaped and softly lit. The telescreen was dimmed to a low murmur. The richness of the dark blue carpet gave one the impression of treading on velvet. At the far end of the room, O'Brien was sitting at a table under a green-shaded lamp with a mass of papers on either side of him. He had not bothered to look up when the servant showed Julia and Winston in. I thought, man, this is exactly what she knew. They're living in the lap of luxury.
Right.
Here, the carpet's like velvet. He says Winston's heart was thumping so hard he doubted whether he would be able to speak. They had done it. They had done it at last, was all he could think. It had been a rash act to come here at all, sheer folly to arrive together, though it was true they had come by different routes and only met on O'Brien's doorstep. But merely to walk into such a place needed an effort of the nerve. It was only very rare occasions that one saw inside the dwelling places of the inner party or even penetrated into the quarter of town where they lived. The whole atmosphere of huge block of flats, the richness and spaciousness of everything, the unfamiliar smell of good food and good tobacco, the silent and incredibly rapid lifts sliding up and down, the white-jacketed servants hurrying to and fro, everything was intimidating. I mean, if you look at it, they're on the same planet.
Right.
You know, they're in London.
Yeah, right.
And here's this one place is absolutely amazing. And then there's another place that's absolutely full of rats.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, that we didn't know that was his big fear. And that's how they finally got him to dump Julia. You know, because they were.
Right.
Yeah, anyway. But it's just amazing. Even the servant, when you read through this, readers, Even the servant is fake.
Right.
he's still a party member.
That's right.
But they got something on him, so he has to pretend he's
right,
a servant.
Right.
So, you know, it just gave me the chills to think of how evil O'Brien is.
Right. Right.
And he seems to love it.
Yeah. And this whole scene here about this posh neighborhood and these houses and the way they live are the very things that societies like communist and socialist societies condemn about capitalist societies, that you have these capitalists that have everything and do everything, and all the masses of people don't have anything. And that's exactly what happens in communist societies. You know, you have these the ruling few who have everything and the masses who have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very ironic the way that plays out in this book.
Yes, very much.
The other thing I think is like 169. We can touch just briefly. What really shocked Winston is O'Brien could turn the telescreen off.
Right. Yeah. They were allowed to do that.
they were allowed to do it.
Not for long. No more than 30 minutes. But
yes,
they could.
But they could turn off the telescreen. That was just absolutely shocking.
Right.
Shocking to them. It says there even Julia uttered a tiny sound, a sort of squeak of surprise. Even in the midst of his panic, Winston was too much taken aback to be able to hold his tongue. "You can turn it off," he said. "Yes," said O'Brien. "We can turn it off. We have that privilege."
Yeah.
I mean, that to me was like made me want to get up
right
and punch O'Brien. but then, to me, it's just really, really evil. So let's talk about how they get discovered. I'll let someone else talk about that. Hear that the shabby antique shop is the den of the thought police.
So you know, it turns out it was. You wonder was it there just to catch them? I mean, how long has that been planned? But it was the man who was the owner was there to catch them, and he wasn't who he looked like he was, and. The room that they used, you know, had a telescreen in it behind the picture.
Yeah,
all that time. So
there's so much there.
I mean, they thought they were in a safe place, and it definitely wasn't. So,
The thing is that to me, that's the height of betrayal. Do you if you remember all the discussions that, like, especially over this little paperweight, and Winston was just enthralled with it. Because it was beautiful,
delicate,
but and he uses a lot of comparison of that how his life is. You know, it's like in a bubble, and he wanted the beauty of it, he wanted the feeling of it, but then and that guy would talk to him about he said the antique business isn't good anymore because people aren't really interested in antiques, and I think they even had a little bit of a history talk there,
right.
Talked about the history of it, so. The thing that's kind of chilling to me about that whole thing that Charrington did this is that they knew him well.
Mm-hmm.
They knew his thinking. And is it because they had so much time with him at the with the telescreen?
Probably so. What's so what's so unsettling about that is the fact that things are never what they seem to be.
Yes.
You know, people who you think are your friends are not your friends. People who you think are people, those who think like you don't think like you. They're on the other side. And so he brings back this whole thing of fear and hatred. That's really what everything's reduced to. It's pretty much fear of everything that's around you and then hatred for that as well. You know, it's sort of a society that's been stripped of everything that's positive.
Right, stripped of everything positive. Because those... Oh, what was it? How many? 5 minutes of hate, or was it three minutes of hate?
Yeah, the 2 minutes of hate.
Two minutes.
But then they had a week.
Then they had the hate week.
And they were working like furiously during this hate week to try to get ready for it.
Yeah, and then they're exhausted by the end of it.
Right.
But the other thing I thought was interesting, when Charrington reveals himself, obviously they know their goose is cooked. Yep. They know it's over. But what happened to, were the proles actors as well? I mean, the lady that's the big lady that has the, you know, all she's doing is working, and you know, she raised her own children. Now she's raising grandkids, and what she does, she washes diapers all the time. But she has this beautiful contralto voice and sings these silly songs,
right.
You know, that are are made by the verisimilitator. It's they're all made up.
Right.
They're all made up by machine. Right. But anyway, but they're gone. You know, if you remember that scene, Winston looks out the window. She's gone. The washing tub is gone.
Yeah.
Everything is like scraped clean. And then they put the ladder in the room and the right. picture falls off the telescreen and they know they're caught. You know, and so were they part of the whole setup?
Or you wonder
well?
If they went, if they ran hiding. You know,
that
you
don't
would,
be they went hiding.
Because mm-hmm. the it seems like the party has really no interest in the proles.
Mm-hmm.
They feel like they're totally controllable because they all they do is bet and, you know, and watch football and all those kinds of things. And so they don't seem to have much concern with what they do.
Mm-hmm.
I would think they probably just, those people just run hiding when they see these police, these thought police come out and take people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It really makes you think, though. So let's talk a little bit about O'Brien, how O'Brien really works him over then, there to get him to break him down. Yeah. 2 plus 2 is still 4 to me.
Well, they had this machine that's apparently some kind of a torture machine that seems to increase. It must be electrical current that they put through them, and they pose these questions and they have to give the right answer to the question, and they keep giving more and more electrical current until they give the right answer. So there's some kind of like brain shock therapy that's going on, and that certainly in addition to the solitary confinement. And then the fear of rats, which is his thing
terrible.
That he hates the most. And that's the very thing that he would, you know, mine would be spiders. I wouldn't want tarantula spiders around. But his was obviously rats. And so when you sort of put all those things together in an environment like that, you're going to get someone to break down. And the idea of what O'Brien says is that we're trying to make you sane.
Yes.
So... So even sanity has now been turned around to insanity. You know, they're trying to make him sane, but he's really sane, and they're making him insane.
It's like he said in the Goldstein chapters, that's doublethink.
Yes, it is doublethink.
It's they want them to be able to hold two conflicting opinions in their mind.
And that, I think, is a fantastic, fascinating reading, that doublethink, those doublethink pages in that chapter with because you realize that's, so much society is like that, really, especially today. When you see what how that talks, and it's interesting.
So the thing that's hard, I think, I know when Deborah first read the book, she says, "Oh," she says, "This is a horrible book."
I agree. That was my first reaction.
I didn't want to keep reading. Well, I wanted to keep reading and hoping that something positive would happen at the end, and it wasn't. You know,
it didn't happen. No, I mean, in fact, he. Mm-hmm. He had no feelings for Julia at the end. I guess they see each other, but what thing that was shocking to me was, don't put my face in the rats, put Julia's face in the rats.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
Which is really like, that's like the, to me, it's the ultimate exception of the acceptance of the inner party.
Right.
But now he's as bad as they are. It's the ultimate betrayal.
Right.
Let her suffer.
Yeah.
You know?
And now he loves the Brotherhood, you know.
And now he loves, right.
So it's like, it's strange how he totally turns around, because you feel like people of his ilk would be the last hope that you would have in that society.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're eliminated, there is no hope left for the society. So.
Yes, basically that's basically the whole book is about there's no hope.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. It is a hopeless book.
Yeah.
unless you accept what Winston says, the hope is in the proles.
Yes.
Yes, right.
That's right.
So maybe we could get rich and write a sequel. Because he's dead now. We could probably get away with it.
Yeah, the proles rise again.
The proles.
Well, did you happen to read a little bit at the end there, what Eric Fromm's, when he talks about the afterword? He just basically says the expression is an expression of a mood, and it's about a warning, and the mood it expresses is that of near despair about the future of man. You know, and a warning about the future of man. So it is, you know, it is about the lack of hope and despair, and you know,
right,
and the warning.
Right. But the thing is I think we have a different perspective, you know, here at the college, and certainly everybody knows that this is sponsored by the Philadelphia Church of God. We do believe the Bible does, it does give you hope,
right?
And the fact that in some ways we can be maybe a little bit more cheery about a book like this because we know it's not going to happen.
Right, right.
That's true.
You know,
that's a relief.
Yeah, to me, I think the value to the book for our readers is to show you this has gone on. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is going on in some area of the world. I mean, if you look at what happened in Cambodia, if you look what happened in China, if you look what's happened into a lot of the Gentile nations of this world, what Orwell has written has happened.
Right.
And the thing is, I think some of it he saw himself when he was mm-hmm. in Burma. But the point is, the reason I think the reason I even wanted to read the book for, you know, Just the Best Literature, because we know there is a future. There is a future hope. And we're not going to live in a world like this. But America is going down. And we have to see that the socialist mindset and even the communist mindset has taken over, you know, really the inner workings of the Democratic Party, and it has really taken over our liberal media. And people are being fed a bunch of lies to make them think we need a socialist society. Right. And this is what we'd get. We'd get Winston, and we would get Julia.
And I think the value of the book is just that.
Right.
I mean, if
yes.
you say, hey, read this book, and this is where we end up mm-hmm. if we keep on the road that we're on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's the frightening thing about it.
Right.
Yes.
But we do know, I mean, we do know that there is going to be a collapse of society and there's going to be nuclear war. But Jesus Christ, you know, has promised, I'm coming back, and he's going to stop it. And then he's going to institute a world of law and government and right education, and people will live, really, they'll live a truly happy life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we have that to look forward to. So I think that's all we have today. It's a little bit longer program. I think what I'll do is I'll come back with a fourth program and I'll just give you some final thoughts on this and then also talk about maybe a little bit more about the wonderful world to come. So sorry that we're out of time for today, but next time I'll give you my final thoughts on George Orwell's dystopian horror story, 1984. And remember, our next book in this series is a young adult fiction titled The Hunger Games. And that's by Susan Collins. It is very popular today, and I think all parents out there need to be reading these books to understand what their children are reading. Now, you can find this book on Amazon for about $8, and if you're not a Prime member, it's going to be just a little bit more. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter on JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And remember, you can leave me a comment at Facebook. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.